Well, thank you, Stafford, for the introduction, and I'm delighted to come and talk about one of the topics that's been one of my passions over the years, thinking about the science of human origins, and thinking, I suppose, historically, particularly about the way in which people of faith, particularly in the Christian tradition, have engaged with those who have worked in various ways on thinking scientifically about human origins. So what I want to do tonight is sort of give you a story about this, one that goes particularly back to about the 16th and 17th century, with ramifications, I hope, coming right up to the present day. But part of what I want to try to show is that thinking about human origins, either scientifically or theologically, has always had political and social and cultural significance. And I want to probe some of the perhaps unexpected ways in which either theological or scientific discovery or discourse about where we came from and therefore who we are. I want to explore some of those byways, and I think they may take us into some realms with which we're perhaps uncomfortable. But I think that's a good lesson for remembering that both theology and science, both of them are always practiced in a particular cultural setting and in a particular cultural context. So I'd hope the screen would be a little bit bigger. Some of the things, the words on it, I will read them. I suspect that from the back you won't be able to see them. For all of that, blame Union College rather than me. I'm sure they'll be happy to take the blame. Now, there's a very interesting passage in the 16th book of St. Augustine's City of God. It's a manuscript version of it, I think, on the screen. And this occurs in the 8th chapter of the 16th book, which St. Augustine devoted to the problem of what were called at that time the monstrous races. Namely, travelers' reports of strange varieties of human-like creatures that inhabited the fringes of the known world. Pygmies, blemmii, they were headless creatures, apparently, with human bodies and faces on their chests. Cyclops, creatures with only one eye lodged in the middle of their foreheads. Cynocephali, I think here's one, if this will work on the screen, probably not, here at the side. Cynocephali, human-like creatures with dog-like heads. And so on. Now, St. Augustine was addressing the question of the monstrous races. They raised a crucial theological question. Were such creatures human beings, or were they not? Were they members of the human family? Did they share human identity? Now, whether such creatures existed or not, Augustine's answer was crystal clear. Let me read it. Whoever is born anywhere as a human being, that is, as a rational moral creature, however strange he may appear to our senses in bodily form, or color, or motion, or utterance, or in any other faculty, part or quality of his nature whatsoever, let no true believer have any doubt that such an individual is descended from the one man who was first created. Wherefore, to conclude this question of the monstrous races, cautiously and guardedly, he went on, either these things which have been told of some races have no existence at all. In other words, we may choose to disbelieve the reports of these travelers to fabulous places. That's one option, disbelieve them. Or if they do exist, we could conclude that they are not human races at all. But here's the linchpin. If they are human, they are descended from Adam. If they are human, they are descended from Adam. For St. Augustine plainly descent from Adam constituted a definition of what it was to be human. To be human, to St. Augustine, is to be a descendant of Adam, to be an Adamite. Now, in one way or another, that answer has echoed its way down through Western history, not just in religious terms, but in a way in secular discourse as well. And as I say, sometimes, as I hope to show tonight, it has had rather disturbing consequences. So what I want to do is chart something of that trajectory this evening, and to illustrate how the question of identity and the question of genealogy were and still are politically charged questions. On the 11th of January 1988, Newsweek magazine ran as its cover story the results of a research project reported by a scientist called Rebecca Cann and her co-collaborator Alan Wilson in the periodical Nature, it had come out the previous year, on the subject of mitochondrial DNA. Now, don't be scared off by the term. The gist of the findings were simply this, that because all of us carry mitochondrial DNA, we only inherit it from our mothers, it remains largely unchanged in transmission from one generation to the next, save for an occasional mutation, and therefore it could be used to define your and my lineage right back, every human being in the world, to a common ancestor. Every single person in this room carries within us the mitochondrial DNA that came from one woman many, many years in the past. The Newsweek headline screamed what it had found: the search for, yes, you got it, Adam and Eve. Mitochondrial Eve is the most recent female from whom we're all descended, in an unbroken line through our mothers. She was a female who roamed the plains of Africa, it's believed, around 200,000 years ago, and now she had appeared on the contemporary genetic stage. Echoing the words of Rebecca Cann herself, Newsweek announced her arrival to the public the following way. Scientists are calling her Eve, but reluctantly. The name Eve evokes too many wrong images. The weak-willed figure in Genesis, the milk-skinned beauty in Renaissance art, the voluptuary gardener in Paradise Lost who was all softness and meek surrender and waist-length gold tresses. By contrast, the scientist's Eve, subject of one of the most provocative anthropological theories in a decade, was more likely a dark-haired, black-skinned woman roaming a hot savanna in search of food. She was as muscular as Martina Navratilova, maybe stronger. She might have torn animals apart with her hands. She probably preferred to use stone tools. Quite a gal. Now, it was only to be expected that Eve's enunciation, we all carry this DNA from this one woman, it wouldn't be long before another hunt was underway. A hunt for her male counterpart. And sure enough, genetic research on the male sex-determining Y chromosome, which is passed on with little change from father to son, presently ushered humanity's most recent fatherly, patrilinear, common ancestor onto the scene. In October 1997, participants at a Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory symposium in New York were told that Y chromosome Adam was an African, and that confirmed the story of Eve. Unfortunately, this primeval couple lived many thousands of years apart. Nonetheless, Adam and Eve, or at least their metaphorical alter egos, have taken center stage in the human story once again. Now, as a literary critic reflecting on these developments, put it a little afterwards, Priscilla Wald, she tellingly made this observation. Like all creation myths, genetics offers a story of origins and a genealogical system that maps not just relationships, but rules that govern relatedness. You see, Genesis narratives, whether Christian or from some other religious tradition, or indeed scientific, are, I want to say, political. And these genetic sagas are no exception. The great American scientist Stephen Jay Gould, for example, very rapidly recruited mitochondrial Eve in support of his politics. That is, a support of anti-racist politics. In a widely distributed public video lecture in 1987 dealing with what he called evolution and human equality, he concluded his expose of scientific racism by turning to what he described himself as the centerpiece of his argument, the use of mitochondrial DNA to reconstruct the biological genealogy of modern humans. And the following year, he confirmed that this tremendously important finding, as he put it, makes us realize that all human beings, despite differences in external appearance, are really members of a single entity that's had a very recent origin in one place. There is a kind of biological brotherhood that's much more profound than we ever realized. Then, a further 10 years later, he said something similar in a piece in 1997 entitled Our Unusual Unity. As he reported, his theory, quotes, made our so-called races effectively equal. Now, it'd be interesting to see, too, of course, that Y-chromosomal Adam was equally recruited for racial politics. The Stanford medical geneticist Peter Underhill observed, "We are all Africans at the Y chromosome level, and we are really all brothers." The ripples have quickly spread in other directions. The BBC News in May 2000, for example, commented on a related research project in the Middle East and announced that Y chromosomal research had shown how Jews and Arabs are genetic brothers. In these scenarios, you see, common descent presumably underwrites human equality. Adam's bloodline, that is, Y chromosome Adam and mitochondrial Eve, their bloodline courses its way through human history, and the scientists are telling us, unites every one of us in a common humanity. Now, in this scenario, it's our history that is our identity. And our identity is our destiny. I think to that degree, they're agreeing with St. Augustine. That's Adam and Eve's gift to us. Y chromosome Adam and mitochondrial Eve, that is, their gift is a compelling basis, it was said, for a new politics of sisterhood and brotherhood. Now, the genetic tracking of humanity's DNA bloodline all the way back to genetic Adam and Eve doesn't exhaust for a minute the contemporary fascination with trying to find Adam's descendants. Far from it. Let me tell you a completely different story and from a completely different political perspective. I discovered this to my dismay one afternoon a few years ago. I was checking online in several used bookstores for the subject of Adam and human origins for a book that I was writing. And of course, by the stage of my research, I was fully expecting to find absolutely nothing new on this subject, because I thought I'd really surveyed all the literature that was to be found. Imagine my surprise when suddenly 8 or 10 titles jumped right out of the screen at me. Titles of works about Adam, human origins, and religion that I'd known nothing about. I was completely taken aback. But the plot thickened, and I soon discovered that all of them were supplied from a single bookseller in the United States, in St. Louis, Missouri, called Westward Trek Books. A quick glance at the store's website made me realize that I was in contact with a disturbing, deeply conservative, fundamentalist, white supremacist group calling themselves the Kingdom Identity Movement, also known as the Christian Identity Movement. Now, some rapid research on this group revealed that this far-right group, a neo-Nazi group, with its religion of race hatred and its roots in British Israelitism, was already the subject of several major studies. It turned out that they were fascinated with Adam's bloodline, every bit as much as the geneticists, but for very different political ends from the geneticists. According to their articles of faith, you won't be able to read this, but I'll read it out. They said, the man Adam is the father of the white race only. Quick glance around the room, and I think you're all safe, according to this. On the basis of this, they went on to say, race mixing is an abomination, a satanic attempt meant to destroy the chosen seed line. Now, as part of this group's propaganda strategy, it had mailed a 6-foot glossy scroll entitled The Adamic Race Pure Blood Seed Line to 3,000 households in northern Idaho in 1998. Viciously anti-Semitic, the poster was designed to separate out a pure white Adamic seed line that served to dehumanize every other non-Adamic lineage. This dual seed line, as it was called, had long been part of this group's virulent theology, positing Adam as the father of the white race only. Other races are of pre- or non-Adamic stock, and they were described, to use their language, as the spawn of Satan. Now, for all its labyrinthine exegetical maneuverings, the political identity of this group and its political theology is remarkably simple. White races are Adamic, the others aren't. Adamic races are superior. They have some intrinsic spiritual and cultural capacities denied to others. So it's the duty of the Adamic race to preserve its bloodline from pollution through interracial mixing. A pathological fixation with breeding has long captivated the movement and its predecessors. Bernard Comparet, for example, staged as a San Diego attorney, began one of his typical sermons with this assertion: the Bible is the history of our people, the white people of the race that loosely we group under the term Anglo-Saxon. Within a few breaths, he was railing against the mongrelization of pure Adamites, and instances of that dreary refrain could be repeated ad lib. Privately published pamphlets of the sort that I was picking up that dreadful afternoon on the internet have included things like, did all races come from Adam? The Negro and the World Crisis? False biblical teachings on the origin of races and interracial marriage, and so forth and so on. Their titles amply convey their sentiments. Even with a smattering of genetics and blood chemistry thrown into the mix, they do little more than demonstrate the supremacist's continuing obsession with Adam's bloodline to satisfy its lust for material, to justify excoriation of non-white peoples and vicious attacks on interracial marriage. Now, in these two introductory stories, many ironies, of course, attend the mappings of the two versions of Adam's genetic lineage. While the secular geneticists exult in tracing humanity back to DNA Adam and Eve, these right-wing theologians, can I say, are populating the past with an entire suite of non-Adamic races whose seed continues to snake its malign way through history. But here's the thing. For very different reasons, tracking Adam's bloodline is crucial to both, though for very different reasons. And indeed, the whole project of elucidating human ancestry continues to attract political and not just theological controversy. So what I'm going to try to do today for the rest of this talk tonight is to is to provide for you what I'm going to call a genealogy of genealogy, a sort of history of this genealogical obsession with Adam. And my first port of call here is what I'm calling Adam's ancestors. Let me just pick out a few dominant landmarks on the horizon and identify some of the spheres into which the idea of Adam's ancestry in one form or another and his descendants have been drawn. Now, very early on, I think in Western history at any rate, the suspicion that Adam might not be the progenitor of all humanity began to surface. It goes back to, I think, before the Middle Ages, but at least to the Middle Ages. And I think it would be fair to say, nonetheless, though, that its first sustained voice in support of the idea of human beings who were not from Adam developed in the 16th century, 17th century, in the writings of a little-known French theologian called Isaac de la Perrère. Now, in 1646, Perrère was putting the finishing touches to a piece of work that he'd done on Greenland. And here it came out, this relation to Greenland, and a very important, work of archaeology, of geography, and of ethnography from the mid-17th century. Now, what was interesting about this was that in looking at this book, he was interested in whether Greenland could be the source of the peopling of the Americas. How did Native American people come to be there? Now, he was interested in maps. He rejected the theory that they might have moved across the Bering Strait, and he also argued that they couldn't have gone the other way on account of the details of his geography here. He therefore proposed that the native peoples of both Greenland and indeed, for that matter, of the Americas, were aboriginal to the region itself. They did not come from anywhere else. They were entirely indigenous and presumably had been brought into being in those geographical regions. Now, the implications of this were far-reaching. The biblical account of creation, he believed, could no longer be taken at face value. He believed he had scientific evidence that there was no possibility of anthropological migration. This raised profound doubts about the adequacy of the traditional story of human descent from a single source. In place of the idea that we're all descended from a single parental couple, he favored what was called a polygenetic version, that human beings come from multiple sources, that there were multiple sites of early creation from which different peoples have descended. Now, if the skeptical thrust of this Greenland thesis remained fairly implicit, there was no mistaking its signature in the really grand profanity that he brought out in 1655, entitled Pre-Adamitai, Pre-Adamic Humans. In this work, the idea that human beings existed before Adam found its first major champion. His proposal was simple. Only the Jews, he believed, were descended from Adam. All other peoples, you and me and everybody else who's non-Jewish, were derived from a non-Adamic progenitor. Now, on the surface, of course, it looked like an exercise in biblical study. Internal matters of how to interpret several verses in the fifth chapter of St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans was the apparent reason that he got into this topic. But if, in fact, it was external scientific data that really were the driving force, data coming from the geographical and anthropological sciences. You see, he culled pagan chronicles. He worked his way through pagan genealogies, Renaissance travel books, to support the idea that there were non-Adamic humans inhabiting the earth. The consequences were of epic proportions. If the taken-for-granted relationship between nature and scripture could no longer be taken for granted, what then? It was regarded as a monumental heresy, And when on a trip he found himself arrested and taken to Rome, he was forced to recant before the Pope in 1656, where he said that in a very famous apology, he's supposed to have reneged on his pre-Adamite theory, but clever devil that he was, he constructed his apology in such a way that he never really admitted that he was wrong. Now, what's interesting here is that perhaps for the first time, non-biblical data were being brought to bear on interpreting the biblical text. Rather than interpreting the text of Scripture internally, extra-biblical findings now had to be accorded some place in interpreting Scripture. Now, just how subversive Pereira intended his proposals to be is actually not very, very clear at all. Certainly, we can see him as attacking Scripture in one sense, and as beginning what later has come to be known as biblical criticism. This is the way that the scholar Leo Strauss wants to read Pereira's intervention. La Pereira, he says, was among the first of those who openly declared their departure from unquestioning acceptance of the Bible. His recourse to Scripture, which has caused so much ridicule to be poured on La Pereira, is no more than an adventitious trimming to a naturalistic and rationalistic theory. Now, if we read this text this way, Pereira is really playing midwife to modern skepticism. But there's some reason to suppose that his aim was not quite so subversive. If one adopted his theory that there were human beings on earth before Adam, and that Adam is only the father of the Jews, that might, in some way, aid the conversion to Christianity of various skeptics. Anthony Grafton puts it this way: by making Genesis a more reasonable text, he would make it more convincing, and thus the heathen would be more receptive to it and would more willingly convert to the true religion, Christianity. You see, if this is the case, you could keep the old 4004 chronology that Usher was currently working on, because all of the 4004 history could be fitted into a period from a Jewish Adam, and then all the other pagan chronicles could be packed in before the biblical text and thereby preserve the Scripture's authenticity. What was the fate of this theory? It did indeed attract an increasing number of sympathetic advocates in succeeding generations. And it's important, I have to say at this point, that you must remember this: Pereira's version was bereft of the racial supremacism that we see the way others used it in a minute or two. Throughout the 18th century and the 19th century, an acrimonious feud was engaged between those who traced humanity back to a single point of origin and those who advocated a multiple origin interpretation. One of the most conspicuous challenges to the traditional understanding of Genesis came from a Scottish lawyer, Henry Home, Lord Kames, who in 1774 published his Sketches of the History of Man. Now, he was not convinced by those who said that racial difference could come about through the influence of the climate on human bodies, or indeed the influence of environmental factors more generally. He was helplessly attracted to the idea that different races had been created by the Creator in different zones across the earth. He was helplessly attracted to polygenism. To him, climate could never produce this degree of human variety. If anything, human varieties were created for particular climates. And so he did much to bring the idea that human beings were of multiple origins. He did much to bring this to prominence. And indeed, a number of people promulgated this thesis with even greater vigor in the years to come. An Anglican clergyman, for example, Griffith Hughes in Barbados, distinguished scientist as well as a clergyman, a fellow of the Royal Society, he was equally sure that the climate certainly could not bring about these changes. He wrote a book on the natural history of Barbados, and in this he declared, and I quote him, "The whites, the Indians, and the blacks differ not accidentally, but originally and really. They were created that way. The Royal Navy surgeon John Atkins, who became an expert in tropical diseases, had much the same to say. In one of his texts, he wrote, "Though it be a little heterodox, I am persuaded that the black and white race have ab origine, from the beginning, sprung from different colored first parents." Clearly, the idea of multiple Adams was now beginning to receive a widespread airing. It surfaced, for example, in the work of an English surgeon, Charles White, who came to the conclusion that the various species of men, I quote him, were originally created and separated by marks sufficiently discriminative. In an important medical text that he wrote right at the end of the 18th century in 1799, he reported that he could find no way of drawing a stable boundary between humans and apes. And then he had this to say: "If we admit that such great varieties can be produced in the same species as we find it to exist in man, humans, it would be easy to maintain the probability that several species of simiae, apes, are but varieties of the species man." What he's saying here is that several species of ape could be seen as varieties of human. "And if the argument be still extended further, almost all the animal kingdom might be deduced from one pair and considered as one family, than which a more degrading notion certainly cannot be entertained. If indeed the racial differences we see could have come from one original parent, there's no reason to see any difference between some of those races and animal races, in particular races of apes." Now, with these proposals were attracting some defenders, they still remain very, very troubling to many people. And here's where we get to a very interesting political dimension of this debate about multiple origins for human beings. What if we were all descended from original, separate progenitors? Samuel Stanhope Smith became the president of Princeton College. It was then the College of New Jersey, a Presbyterian. And he entered into a dialogue with that original text I mentioned by Lord Kames, the Scottish jurist. In contrast to what Kames was saying, Stanhope Smith believed that Adam's blood ran in every single human vein. He believed that human variation could be explained by adaptation to climate. And he protested that that was both doctrinally and scientifically plausible. What was his motivation for doing so? The plural origins of the human race, Smith believed, would necessarily disrupt this idea which was crucial to him: a single, universal human nature. If there were many different human natures, because there were many, many different first parents, he believed that that would entirely subvert the possibility of any moral order in a public society. His only environmentalist scheme, he thought, of course, preserved that. What he was worried about were the political implications. And this is how he put it in a very famous essay, which was entitled "An Essay on the Causes of the Variety of Complexion in the Human Species." Now, this is just at the period of signing of the American Constitution. And the problem with signing the American Constitution, the issue was this: if you had thrown over monarchy, inherited privilege, and indeed religion as the cementing force that would hold together your society, where else could you turn but to a common human nature? This is what Smith has to say. I must repeat here an observation which I made in the beginning of this essay. The denial of the unity of the human species tends to impair, if not entirely destroy, the foundation of duty and morals, and in a word, of the whole science of human nature. No general principles of conduct or religion, or even of civil policy, could be derived from natures originally and essentially different from one another, and afterwards, in the perpetual changes of the world, infinitely mixed and compounded. But when the whole human race is known to compose only one species, this confusion and uncertainty is removed, and the science of human nature in all its relations becomes susceptible of system. Now, what's the conclusion? With a single origin point and a single human nature, he concludes, the principles of morals rest on sure and immutable foundations. To Stanhope Smith, preserving a line, a single line of all humanity to Adam, was not only scientifically sound, and it wasn't only theologically orthodox, it was politically necessary in order to ensure the kind of civil arrangements that he hoped would characterize the new United States of America. And yet, for all this appeal to the heterodoxy of non-Adamic races and the orthodoxy of the Adamite story, the notion of pre-Adamic humans soon began to become peacemakers in the relations between science and religion. In order to maintain peaceful relations between the science of anthropology and theology, versions of this theory began to reassert themselves throughout the 19th century. Just one or two examples. This was the case, for example, in this book, The Genesis of the Earth and Man in the Mid-19th Century, 1856, by a distinguished scholar by the name of Edward William Lane, who traveled widely in the Middle East, was an outstanding Arabic scholar and particularly student of language. He was also, by the way, a skilled artist. And you can, for a few minutes, if you're getting tired of this, meditate on the beauties of his Orientalist art here. To him, of course, his interest was this: could all languages have descended from a single source? Would there be enough time, even allowing for whatever might have happened at Babel, would there be enough time for the differentiation of languages to have come into being in the short space of time available from Adam? His answer was no. He certainly didn't think so. And what he proposed, therefore, was a multiple origin account of human language systems. You can see here at the top is what he calls primeval languages. But it's particularly these ones that he calls the prototype of the Semitic. Can you see this in the middle? That are of most interest. Notice the names here: Hamitic, Semitic, and Japhetic. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. Of course, from these language traditions, he's not using these as literal names, he's using these as language family names, but he believes they came from a prototype of the Semitic. He called this the Adamic language. But in order to understand the linguistic complexity that characterized the entire globe, he was required to have a whole set of primeval languages, Turanian and the Grecian, which he thought also survived into his own day. And from this mixture of languages, we get the incredible range of linguistic systems that characterize the world today. He believed in doing so that he would preserve the truth of the biblical story rather than undermine it. Another case of this was an interesting text with the title, The Harmony. Have I missed one? Is that the right one? Okay. Yes, that's right. Adam and the Adamite, the subtitle of which is The Harmony of Scripture with Ethnology. It was written by an Irish lawyer by the name of Dominic McCausland, and it came out in the 1860s. Now, McCausland's interest was in upholding the detailed accuracy of Scripture in the face of challenges from science. And his argument was that if the standard story of descent from Adam continued to receive support, he argued that the assaults of geology, history, archaeology, and philology would simply reduce the book of Genesis to, quotes, the fanciful speculations of some visionary mythologist. But he said, happily, that would be too fast a judgment. The biblical Adam was only the last of a series of human types that God had created on earth. Superior to his forebears, Adam's appearance out of nothing in the image of God was recorded for all posterity, although in a short time this pure Adamic line would be sullied through intermarriage with pre-Adamic stock. But you see, his aim was to safeguard Scripture, not undermine it, even though he was using an idea that had been originally castigated as a monumental heresy. So you see what's happening. This polygenic theory begins to find favor with Christian apologists and indeed with scientific racists alike in order to try and cope with the relations of science and faith. Let me move very quickly to, interest of time, I'll not worry about this one, to what happens when the Darwinian interventions begin to take place. Now, on the surface, you might think that Darwinian evolution would have sounded the death knell to these polygenetic speculations. In fact, that would be entirely mistaken. What's also readily detectable is that among scholars with Christian commitments, pre-Adamite theories began to be rejuvenated again, this time to meet the challenge of evolutionary biology. Typically, these champions began to think that pre-Adamites might not be fully human beings, and that Adam really was the first true human, but a descendant of pre-hominid organisms of one sort or another. Perhaps chief of them among these was an American Methodist and geologist by the name of Alexander Winchell. He has this to say when he's proposing this, that humans had first emerged many years before Adam in Africa. These first humans were likely black. And then he goes on to say, "The time arrived at length when, under the law of progressive development, a grade had been reached nearly on a level with that of modern civilized man in respect to native capacities. Now appeared the founder of the Adamic family. His home was in Central Asia." You see, by this move, Winchell could open up an entire pre-biblical chronology, and he could exploit that for scientific purposes. Now, I'm sorry to say that Methodist though he was, his texts were laced with the most vitriolic bile as far as racial difference was concerned. He railed against the Adamic bloodline being adulterated, I quote him, with Negro blood. And of course, I suspect this is not surprising, since at the time he was living in the American South, right in the time of, in the wake of the American Civil War. Now, as I say, you might be inclined to think that Darwin's followers with the theory of common descent would not accept this notion of multiple human origins. And in fact, Darwin himself, though he was very, very much opposed to slavery and a very strong advocate of abolitionism, you can find in his writings very considerable racist rhetoric. With the notion of very, very significant differences between the capabilities and the achievements of different human races. The theory of evolution, I have to say, was entirely compatible with scientific racism of one sort or another. But it's also clear that it was compatible with multiple notions of human origins, notions of multiple human origins. For example, later, Thomas Henry Huxley, writing about this as an evolutionist and a Darwinian, said that it was entirely possible to admit that Negroes and Australians, Negritos and Mongols, are distinct species or even distinct genera, and yet you may, with perfect consistency, be the strictest of monogenists. Well, in the long run, this particular theory, at any rate, proved attractive to those trying to harmonize the new theory of evolution with Christian theology. But by now, this talk of pre-Adamites was more or less exclusively restricted to theological conservatives, namely those for whom the idea of a literal Adam still retained doctrinal significance. Their project to preserve continuity with their own religious traditions and at the same time to take paleoanthropology with real seriousness encouraged the thought that Adam, the first true human, the first with the image of God, was actually descended from pre-Adamic hominids. In the 20th century, the distinguished surgeon A. Rendell Short, for example, a vigorous apologist for evangelical Christianity, and the Royal College of Surgeons Hunterian professor did exactly this. Here's what he had to say by the 1930s. There might conceivably have been pre-Adamic creatures with the mind and body of a man, but not the spirit and capacity for God and eternity. What he's moving to here is now a definition of human identity that stresses the spiritual components rather than simply an issue of genealogy. By 1942, he was confident, for example, that the Neanderthals were pre-Adamites and that the biblical Adam had been formed after the Neanderthals by the infusion of spiritual qualities being injected into some pre-Adamic creature. Now, I did want to say something about the Eve question, but I don't think I have very much time to say this in the light of where I want to get in the last 10 minutes or so. So I'll perhaps skip over this. Forgive me just jumping over a couple of the points that I'd hope to make. We can pick these up in discussion afterwards. It's just that we've spoken so much about the creation of Adam, I felt it would be valuable to say something about Eve. But instead of this, I just want to move to the next point, which is the way in which, amazingly, in the 20th century, the notion of a whole set of non-Adamic races was actually championed of all things by American fundamentalists and by British ones as well. Support for this notion of a pre-Adamic race was not restricted either to liberal Christians or to Christian evolutionists. In fact, the theory flourished among some early 20th century creationists, anti-evolutionists, and thus all the more instructive. Sir Ambrose Fleming, for example, was the first president of the evolution protest movement and a distinguished professor of electrical technology at the University College London. He actually argued for this pre-Adamic theory and then the special creation of humans, but that still Adam could be the descendant of a pre-Adamic creature. It provoked, of course, a lot of controversy in the newspapers at the time, but he believed that Neanderthal man was a pre-Adamic non-human creature and that Cro-Magnons were indeed the first true humans, and Adam indeed was one of those. In fact, the idea was also taken up in the United States by people who were fundamentalists in support of the cause of people like D.L. Moody and so on, arguing for a whole gap that you could place all these peoples in and before the first couple of verses of the book of Genesis. And it's been taken up, I suppose, more or less in our own day by a set of evangelical Protestants such as, let me just see if I've, just to give you the, yes, pre-Adamic hominids and modern evangelicalism. It's been adopted by the Genesis commentator Derek Kidner in a book published by the InterVarsity Press. If God initially shaped man by a process of evolution, it would follow that a considerable stock of near humans preceded the first true man, and it would be arbitrary to picture these as mindless brutes. Derek Kidner specifically goes way back to Pereire in coming forward with this particular theory. The geneticist at UCL, Sam Berry, RJ, in a section in this little book called Adam and the Ape, entitled Pre-Adamic Man, wrote this: "Man is distinguished from the animals only in his spiritual qualities. Consequently, it's reasonable to suppose that God placed his image in an already existing animal." This was the pre-Adamic animal. And indeed, I suppose, most well-known, John Stott, evangelical statesman, has this to say: "My acceptance of Adam and Eve as historical is not incompatible with my belief that several forms of pre-Adamic hominid may have existed for thousands of years previously. These hominids began to advance culturally. They made their cave drawings, buried their dead. It's conceivable that God created Adam out of one of them." Well, that's the story as far as I want to bring it up to date. I just want to have a couple of concluding observations about wider domains here, and then just a very final little comment of my own to conclude. Now, it's pretty clear that many of these accounts about Adam were driven by a passion to harmonize Christianity with scientific enterprises, to harmonize science and scripture. And it's pretty clear that adopting this pre-Adamic or non-Adamic theory was intended as a sort of conceptual bridge between knowledge and belief. But I think that's not exactly the right way to think of it. It's not so much that it was a bridge. It rather became, I would like to think of it as a mold that sculpted both the commitment to science and changed theological conviction into a distinctive shape. What I'm saying here is that harmonizing schemes are not to be thought of as passively zipping together two disparate sets of beliefs. Rather, harmonizing schemes are agents that actively fashion both the scientific theory to which people will commit and the religious doctrines that they hold into new forms. Scientifically, if you adopted this non-Adamic scheme, depending on the precise version that you adopted, it predisposed its advocates to certain kinds of explanations. It led them to think in particular ways about language. It led them to think about, in particular ways, about the role of the environment in modifying organisms. It led them to think in particular ways about whether human and other types were fixed or whether indeed they underwent evolutionary change. But in fact, it also had massive religious implications for how one was to think of the doctrine of the fall, the image of God, what the soul might be, and how one should interpret sacred texts. You see, harmonizing strategies are rarely single unit ideas. Instead, they're conceptual systems, packages of ideas that transform the very ideas that they are trying to unite. But the second thing I want to say about it, which has been really the burden of what I've been saying tonight, is that our analysis shows that the history of these ideas, human origins, both theologically and scientifically, cannot be conducted simply on the intellectual plane of a dialogue between science and religion. From its earliest days, these schemes have been involved in cultural politics. The reason, of course, is that the story of Adam and Eve itself is pregnant with socio-political significance. It tells us about the nature of human identity, the relationship between the sexes, the unity of the human family, the genesis of hatred, the emergence of crime. All of these are incorporated into the Mosaic narrative. And any tampering with that particular story is seen by many to disrupt the settlement. The supposition of an inhabited world before Adam raised profound anxieties about whether we all shared a human common nature, what the relationship might be between the Adamic family and their non-Adamic counterparts, and also about who really owns the biblical story. All humanity, or just the Jews? From its earliest days, pre-Adamite speculations were profoundly implicated in questions of race. It began as a theory to recapture the centrality of the Jewish experience in scriptural economy and in global history. It ended up, ironically, as a weapon of flagrant anti-Semitism. La Perrière cast Adam as the father of the Jews. The pre-Adamites were Gentiles. Some others followed her example, his example. But latter-day white supremacists, of course, presume that Adam was white and that the Adamic line is Caucasian, and they find their justification in their reading of Genesis for locating Jewish origins in some act of gross sexual union hidden in the early text of Genesis with corrupt pre-Adamites. The gross racism that came to monopolize certain segments of pre-Adamite opinion thus marks a striking departure from its earlier incarnations. In the early days, it was used to sweep all nations into the benefits of God's redemption. Now it was used by the supremacists to exclude whole races from God's redemption. So to conclude then, Adam's long shadow. I think there's been an extraordinary persistence of this passion to track Adam's bloodline, whether scientifically or theologically, right down to the present day. At the same time, this story has shown remarkable versatility, a versatility of the idea that Adam's family tree might not embrace all branches of the human species. The theory was born in skepticism and nourished in sacrilege, and yet it came to reside in the writings of the most conservative of theological writers, who found in it a means of accommodating their faith to science. But I think the shadow goes on into the future. I wrote a book about this some years ago as I come to my conclusion, and it came out just a few months after another book that came out from a colleague of mine, Peter Harrison, at the University of Oxford. Peter Harrison's book is a very interesting one. It was called The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science. And in this book, Harrison sets out to challenge the idea that science has been an inherently skeptical enterprise. To the contrary, he wants to argue that certain religious conceptions were at the fountainhead of the development of modern science. And interestingly, he thinks that the most crucial one was the story of Adam's fall. Adam's corruption had so corrupted the human being in all its capacities that there was a need to develop a whole set of modern scientific pieces of instrumentation to overcome the drawbacks that the fall had imposed on human sight, on human minds, on our theories of knowledge, and the like. It was the attempt to overcome Adam's fall that really, he argues, led to the birth of the modern scientific enterprise. It was doubts about humanity's cognitive capacities that kick-started discussions that brought about the new experimental philosophy. So he thinks that Adam was crucial, or the idea of Adam, to the birth of science. Now, why do I mention this seems to be going off the track? Well, it's for this reason. Peter's volume came out just a few months before a book that I had published on this sort of topic came out, and it was reviewed by a young scholar, very young scholar, reviewing both of these in an intriguing review that raised a question for me, I think, that continues to haunt me. And this is what he has to say in this very interesting discussion. The story of Adam and Eve, he writes, has been an idée fixe of the Western imagination for many millennia. But now, he says, has the story compensated us for all this unrelenting devotion? Let me just see if it's the... Ah, yes, I'm getting to that now. His answer, I think, is highly suggestive. Here's what he says about the significance of Adam. On the one hand, modern scientific reflection took its shape against a horizon dominated by Adam's haunting shadow. The techniques and instruments of modern science were all ad hoc remedies for what we had all lost at the fall. On the other hand, this is where he gets to my book, it's impossible to recount the history of the human sciences, including English and European colonialism. It's impossible to recount these histories without noticing the ways in which a given population's imagined descent or non-descent from Adam was a switch point for fixing how they would be analyzed and governed. Since the 17th century, part of what it has meant to be a particular kind of Western human has been dominated in part by whether they are not of an Adamic pedigree. Simply but dramatically put, Adam has played a crucial part in giving us science and in giving us ourselves. If, as the theoretician Paul Ricoeur once observed, Adam's fall from grace is the anthropological myth par excellence, I suggest to you the mission to track Adam's bloodline must surely rank as the archetypal quest of our own Western culture. Thank you. Thank you.